How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
On the show today, original member of the Big Three, Robert Parrish.
It's time. You want the best Celtics talk around? Here it is. This is the Rain and Jays podcast. Here's John and Jay.
Oh, yeah. This is an exciting day, everybody. I could not be more pumped for this show. So, Jay is ready. I am ready. Let's just dive right into it and bring in our guest, the Hall of Famer, original member of the Big Three, one of the 50 greatest players of all time. No one has played more NBA basketball than our guest right now, Robert Parrish. Chief, thank you for joining us today. You were known as a pretty good jump shooter as a center. If you played today, do you think that you could fit into the style and maybe extend your range? Could you get out to the corner and hit a three in today's game?
No, sir. I am not a three-point shooter. My range is out to 18 feet. And that's about as far as I can shoot it accurately. But because of the freedom and space that is created by the perimeter game today, I think I would fit in effectively because I can go outside. So I would be an inside-outside player.
So you would hit the post first, would you? What do you think What do you think about these guys that you're being asked to shoot from three? What would you tell a coach today if he said, "Hey, let's get you out into the corner. Let's see what you can do."
Well, the coach got to respect me because I know my limitations, and so I know that's not me. One player that mirrors my game, I think, is Paul Gasol, that plays for the Chicago Bulls. He has the ability to go out to 18 feet, and he plays inside, outside. So his game mirrors my game, in my opinion. Even though he has better range, I think he's capable of shooting three-pointers.
That's an interesting comparison. I never linked those two together, but that is a good comparison. Now you played more than 20 seasons in the NBA. How did you stay healthy and motivated for that long?
Well, obviously, I have had a love affair for the game, and I never sustained a major injury. That played a part. Genetics played a part. And to hop on that old cliche, I kept myself in great physical condition year round, which most pro athletes do anyways.
Now, was there any trick? Did you do yoga? Anything like that? Was there a trick to it?
Well, stretching definitely played a part. I took some yoga classes and also took some martial arts. I studied martial arts for 10, 12 years and big emphasis on stretching. And also the yoga, obviously, focuses on stretching. So I did a lot of stretching, and I think that enabled me to keep my flexibility and keep me agile. Because as you age, you get stiffer, a little tighter. And you're not as mobile. So I think the stretching played a major part, a reason why I was able to play as long as I played.
What kind of martial arts did you do?
Kung Fu.
Kung Fu? Now, did you become a black belt? How far did you reach?
They don't give belts, you know, okay. In Kung Fu. But I'll just say this. I can take care of myself. I'll leave it at that.
We will not test that at all. But I'm sure Bill Laimbeer can attest to that.
Maybe.
another guy who can attest to that, Michael Jordan. You kind of got into it with him at practice. What happened there?
Well, Michael has a tendency to test his teammates. especially the new faces on the team. And I think it was more of a test than a threat. He was just testing, you know, my reaction to his being a bully. And so I didn't back down. You know, he said he would kick my butt. And I told him, if you feel that strongly about it, come and get some. That was the end of it. You know, we didn't have another confrontation, if you will. It was just a test. I like I said, I don't think, at least I didn't read anything into it. I think it was just a test to see how I respond.
How close were you to actually fighting Michael Jordan?
He was at half court, and I was at the top of the key. and also, I think he was a little ticked off, too, because the second team was kicking their butt at the time, and I was talking trash, too.
Yeah, see, a lot of people don't think of you as a trash talker. Larry was the trash talker, right?
Yes.
But you go ahead.
But only reason why I was talking trash to Michael was because he and Scotty was enjoying their dominance over the second team. And then when the second team finally got a center that could enhance their abilities, the first team no longer could enjoy dominance over the second team. So I just want to let them know that they're no longer the king on the block.
That's amazing. Let's go back a little bit to the trade, because right now this new generation of Celtics fans, they're enjoying this the progression of a trade that could be one of the best trades in franchise history. But you happen to be part of the best trade that essentially brought you and Kevin McHale to Boston that created the Big Three. So think back to that day when you first got the call in Golden State, you're going to Boston. What were the thoughts that were going through your head at that time?
I was surprised initially, but once I hung up from the Warriors after they called me and told me that I was being traded to the Boston Celtics, I cheered and I jumped up and down and I treated myself to a stiff drink. Because I went from purgatory to the penthouse, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that worked out well.
Oh, yeah, very well. For me, anyway. I can't speak for the Warriors. But for me and my career, being traded to the Celtics changed the trajectory of my career.
That's so funny, because our next question was, how much did you think that changed your personal career trajectory? Obviously, it helped you play for some incredible teams. But personally, how much did it change?
Oh, it gave me incentive, and I was motivated to play the game again, because I was seriously thinking about having a very short basketball career before the trade, because of all the losing that I experienced with the Warriors and being blamed for the Warriors' demise. I understand it, because I was the number one player taken, and the blame falls on my shoulder. But basketball is not an individual sport. It's a team sport. And I just feel like the team was an assemble of misfits and too much independent thinking. Guys are thinking about themselves as opposed to the team. And that was so rewarding about being with the Celtics, because they was all about team. You know, you play for the name on the front of the jersey, not the name on the back of the jersey. So it was refreshing for me, because that's my mentality.
So the man who played more than anybody in the NBA may have actually played a very short career had you stayed in Golden State.
Oh, no question about it. With the players I was playing with, I could not get them to understand the benefits and the rewards of playing together. They didn't get it for whatever reason.
And then you go to the Celtics, and they do get it. One of the teams that you played for that was probably, I would assume that you would agree, it's the best team you played for, the 85-86 Celtics.
Ooh.
Did you guys have as much fun as it seemed? What was it like playing for that particular team?
It was a beautiful time in my professional career, playing with like-minded people. We all on the same page, competing for one goal, and that's to achieve excellence in regards to the NBA championship. And I have so much respect for that team because everybody on that team put their egos aside for the team. And that's rare. You talking about some major egos in that locker room. And we sacrifice our egos to try to achieve a common goal. And that's why I have so much respect for those players.
Was that a collective thing? Like, how do you – because that is the same thing that is said of the new Big Three era with Garnett and Pierce and Ray Allen, that egos were sacrificed to achieve that common goal. Was there a particular player in that locker room that kind of led that charge? Did somebody have to be put in line? How does something like that happen? Or does everybody just realize it at the same time? We have to play a certain way.
It starts at the top. Red preaches selflessness. Starts with him. And then the coach preached the same rhetoric. And then the players got to buy into that philosophy. Because it won't work if the players don't buy into it. And we all want to be winners. We all want to be champions. And that played a part also. So the Red and the coaches really didn't have to do much of a selling job in terms of making sacrifices. Because it's something that the players wanted anyways. And we all believe you can never have enough championships, ever. And I think it's one of the reasons why Larry Kirby and myself are Hall of Famers. I don't think it's so much about our individual talents. I think it says a lot about the great teams that we were a part of. I think that's one of the main reasons why we are Hall of Famers today, in my opinion.
Now, do you ever go back and watch highlights of that team and think, man, we could really pass it?
I don't have to. It's etched in my brain. I don't need to watch any film. I experienced it firsthand. My only regrets when I think back on my career, especially when I was with the Celtics, I wish I had taken more time to enjoy the journey. I really didn't understand how special it was and how rewarding and gratifying the experience was until after I retired.
So what?
At what moment did it hit you, kind of?
Well, maybe a year later. I reflect back on my career about a year after I had retired. I just sitting down one day idly thinking about a lot of different things, and then my career appeared on my noggin, and then I started thinking about I had one hell of a career. And then how many players can say that they played with, let's see, I think I played with like 7 or 8 Hall of Famers. Think about that for a second. How many players can say that? How many athletes can say that?
Now, you have definitely had a very storied career. There's no doubt about that. Your teams are the teams that really I grew up on. And how much did you guys really hate the Pistons? Like, legitimately in your hearts? Like, or how much of it was just professional rivalry?
I think hate is too strong of a word, but it was a very healthy dislike, not only for the Pistons, but the 76ers, the Lakers. I think Dallas was a pretty good team. The Dallas Mavericks, we didn't like them either. San Antonio, we didn't like them either. Every team that we considered competition for the championship, we had a healthy dislike for them.
So when a guy like LeBron James comes out and says, yeah, I'd love to play with this guy and that guy and that guy and that guy for a few years, and they're all on different teams, how does that strike you? How do you think the attitudes have changed, and why have they changed so much over the years?
Well, I think the correct terminology would be the millenniums, things have changed. It's a new era. I think the players of the day, not only the players, but young people today are more accepting, are more liberated in their thinking. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's easier for the players today to embrace the philosophy of joining forces or ranks with their contemporaries to enhance their careers. Personally, I don't see nothing wrong with it, because I guess in a roundabout way, you can say I did it, even though it wasn't under my control or my power. I was traded, but I joined forces with two hell of a players too. So technically, you can say that about me. Even though I was traded, I didn't go on my own free will, but I did the same thing. When you think about my career,
I get the feeling you probably would have gone on your own free will anyway, based on your thoughts about the Warriors.
Oh, I would have left the Warriors. Oh, but when you're in a good situation, take for granted all the rhetoric and the narrative out there about Kevin Durant joining the Warriors to try to win a championship. Not that he will. That's just the narrative out there, you know, the spin out there right now. Now, think about that for a second.
Yeah, they'd be a pretty talented team.
Oh, and all of them are young, too. My only question about that is Durant's defense. I don't think his defense is on the same level with his offensive prowesses. He needs to pick it up on the defensive end. With his skill set, he should be a much better defensive player. Consistently. Yeah. He's not consistent with his efforts on the defensive end.
You make a valid point there.
That would be my only concern about him joining the Warriors, because I think they would take a step back defensively. And not to mention what they had to give up to add Durant to the roster.
Yeah, and then there's the whole chemistry thing would be tough. And...
yeah, you got to think about all that too, the chemistry, the camaraderie. That it just kind of throws things out of balance for a minute. I think if anybody could make a smooth transition to that team, because Durant has the mentality of he don't have to be the man on the team, obviously, because he lets Westbrook be the man for the most part. So I think he can make a smooth transition in that regard.
Yeah, now we're talking about Kevin Durant, one of the greatest players in the NBA today. You play with two of the greatest players ever, including Michael Jordan and Larry Bird, and among many, many other Hall of Famers. But those two guys specifically, how are those similar and different as competitors?
The similarities between Larry, Kevin, and Michael is that their unquenchable desire to win and be successful. They had a thirst that just couldn't be quenched. And their drive and their ambition. And one thing I like about those three players that I play with, and you could throw Scottie Pippen in there also, is that during their premium years, they got better every year. I always respected that. They never gloated, got by on their past achievements. Every summer, they got better. Every year they came back, they were a better player. And that's one of the reasons why I hold them in such high regard as athletes, because that's something that I try to do in my own personal career. I try to be a little bit better during my premium years every time I came back for the upcoming season.
How does a player do that? Like when you go into an off season thinking, do you think I need to add one more element to my game? Do you try to refine something in your game you think that might need a little enhancement? What's the mentality in going into the summer especially for you, because you were constantly in the playoffs, winning championships. You're playing very long seasons, so you needed to rest as well. How does a player go from great to even better over the off season?
Well, for me personally, I take 3 weeks off. I don't do anything, let my body calm down, heal up a little bit. Then I'm right back on the grind. What makes great players great, in my opinion? They have great work ethics, a thirst to be better. So you work on your weaknesses. You're always working on your weaknesses, whatever your weaknesses may be. You don't have a good left hand. You're not good going to your left. Your dribbling needs to improve. Your passing needs to improve. Your free throw shooting. Your shooting. And also, while you're working on your weaknesses, you're also working on your strengths also. And then also, you're working on your defense, because everybody can improve defensively. Always. Because that's mental. That has very little to do with talent. Defense is psychological. Mental. You got to want to be a good defensive player consistently. And so those are the things that you gotta do to make yourself great and keep yourself great. You got to have a love affair with getting better. Matter of fact, you should be in love with the process, because you're not always going to be rewarded with success, especially when things are not going well, because from my perspective, sports mirrors life. It ebbs and it flows. And when your game is ebbing, that's when you got to learn the process of getting better and correcting what's wrong with your game, why you're not playing well.
Yep. Now you've talked about these guys, Kevin McHale and Larry Bird. One thing, a few years ago, there was an article, I think it was in the Boston Globe, and one thing that stood out to me about it was that you don't seem to be too tight with those guys these days. What was your relationship like with those guys when you did play together?
We were never tight. I wouldn't say we were friends. We never went out to dinner, movies. Besides, they were married, and except for 2 years in my stay in Boston when I was married, I was a single man. We don't have nothing in common except for basketball. I wouldn't call them friends. The two players on the team that I would call friends would be Dennis Johnson and Bill Walton. They were my friends. Because we did things together. We hung out. We interacted with one another. Kevin, Larry, and myself, we didn't interact off the court. So I never considered us to be friends. We are friendly and respectful towards one another, obviously. We wouldn't have the camaraderie and the chemistry on the court, but I wouldn't call them friends. And it's nothing personal. Now, I don't want you to read into this that I got an axe to grind with them, because I don't. I respect them. We just not friends.
Now, how do you build such great chemistry with those guys if you're not close? It seems like a lot of people think you have to be friends in the locker room to have that chemistry.
No, you do not. No, you don't have to be, going out to dinner and the movies, off the court. On the court, we share a common goal. All of us want to achieve excellence. We all willing to make sacrifices for that goal. And not to mention, there's a very healthy respect between us. We all respect one another. I don't think that ever changed. We ain't got to be hugging and kissing. At least from my perspective, anyways.
Yeah. Now you said one person who helped build that camaraderie was Red Auerbach from the top. Everyone I talk to seems to have a favorite Red Auerbach story. Do you have one?
I have a favorite story. Something that Red told me, because as you probably remember, when I got traded from the Golden State Warriors to the Boston Celtics, there were some questions about me as a player and about my game, because I really hadn't established myself just yet. And so when Dave Cowens decided to retire during the exhibition season, my first year in Boston, Red came to me and pulled me aside and told me that Do not listen to the media and the critics, because they can be very harsh. And he told me, you know what you can and cannot do, and just go out and be Robert Parrish. Do not listen to the noise, because that's their job, to question, to second guess, and to critique you as a player. You just do you. And that's the most profound advice that Red ever gave me, and I respect him for that, because he didn't have to say a word to me. It's my job to go out and try to fill that void that Dave Cowens left.
Now, how much did you need that particular advice to kind of come in and be yourself?
I didn't need it, personally, because I'm self-motivated. I don't need any outside motivation. My motivation comes within, because obviously I was good enough to be in the NBA, so it's up to me to improve and be better so I can stay in the league, because it's one thing to get drafted into the NBA, but you got to do whatever it takes to stay there, be a profession, because I feel like if you're not trying to get better as a person, as an athlete, you're doing yourself, your teammates, the game, the organization, a huge disservice.
The NBA season is a very long grind. It's 82 games plus the playoffs. You're working with these guys every day, traveling. And not only that, back when you were playing, you guys were traveling coach, right?
No, we was in first class.
First class.
We
but you were commercial. You're flying commercial.
We had a private plane. Is that what you had?
That's what I mean. I meant you. Yeah, but you were flying commercial. You had to, like, schedule flights.
Right.
So, first of all, on a back-to-back, can you explain a little bit because nowadays on a back-to-back, guys can get on their private plane, it's waiting for them, you get to the next city, and it's still a grind, but it's not what you guys had to do. So can you explain a little bit of what the process of playing a back-to-back game was back in the 80s?
Oh, it was definitely a grind back then, because a back-to-back, that means you had like a 7 o'clock flight or a 6:30 flight. So that means you got a wake-up call at like 4 in the morning, 4:30 in the morning to get to the airport. Plus, you got to take into consideration all the luggage that you got to get checked. And so, and then you're not getting enough rest, because after the game, you wound up, you don't get to sleep. At least for me, I didn't get to sleep till like 1, 2 in the morning, because I'm so wound up at the game from all that physical exertion. And so by the time you doze off, it's time to get up. Then you're not getting your proper rest. Now your body clock is all thrown off. And that sometimes it hampers your performance the following night, because you don't get enough rest. Because you're sleeping all day, which I don't think is good, because then you, at least for me, it makes me lethargic when I'm trying to make up for lost sleep. And then you're trying to wake your body up and get ready for the game the following night. So it definitely was challenging. So it just put more emphasis on keeping myself in the best physical condition that I possibly could be in, and to maintain it, because I think that helps with the physical challenges of an NBA season.
So you would get a 4 o'clock wake up call. You'd go to the hotel. Would you have to wait in line to personally check your bags?
No, we didn't have to check out bag. We had an equipment manager.
Okay, thank God.
That did all that, but you still got to get up. You got to pack, you know, and you got to get to the airport. You're pretty much sleepwalking, at least for me sometimes, because it always took me a while to unwind after a game.
That's still amazing. And then you'd have to go out and bang with Lambeer the next night.
Oh, definitely. That's where the professionalism comes in. You got to be a professional. Every night, I always had the mindset, somebody's watching me play for the first time. So I took it as a personal challenge to be the best I could be every night out for that person that's seeing me play for the first time. I thought it was important. for me to be my very best every night out.
So this is a long grind. It's tough. You're playing against, I think, back then, the competition, so many great players and so many great teams. You spent a lot of time doing very serious work on the court, but the locker room, there had to be some fun moments because you got to break the stress and everything. So what's the funniest thing that you remember from your days in the NBA in the locker room?
Well, it wasn't so much in the locker room. We had this radio commentator, Johnny Most, and he was a chain smoker. He smoked cigarette after cigarette after cigarette. So one of my teammates, Danny Ainge, got these, I don't know what you would call them, these candy cigarettes that explode after you light them. Had the explosive tip. And so Danny replaced three or four of Johnny Most cigarettes with these explosive cigarettes. And so Johnny Most always slept on the plant. Every flight, he went to sleep. And so when he woke up, first thing he did was he lit up a cigarette. And so he would light up a cigarette, and then it would explode. He'd be like, "What the MF?" And then he'd take out another cigarette, and it would explode. He'd be like, "What MF bothered my cigarettes?" And then he'd take out another one, and it would explode. And then he's getting up, ranting up and down the hall. I mean, down the walkway. And of course, the steward just got to intervene after that, because you're not supposed to be walking up down the aisle where and throwing a temper tantrum. And so we all about falling out of our seats with laughter. Everybody thought it was funny, but Johnny Most.
That is an amazing story. I have to say that's a perfect place for us to end this conversation. We don't want to take up too much of your time. I do want to say that people do have an opportunity to come out and meet you in Saugus Friday, April 15th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the I Love Boston Sports Store at the Square One Mall in Saugus. So, if you want to come out and meet Robert Parrish, who has just had given us an amazing conversation, Friday, April 15th from 7 to 9 at the Square One Mall in Saugus. Robert Parrish, thank you very, very much for your time. It was a great conversation.
Thank both of you for the memories, and I appreciate it. I enjoyed it. Thank you much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Have a nice day.
You do the same. Bye.
Jay, that was such an amazing conversation. I went into it without any idea of what to expect because, you know, Robert Parrish has his reputation of stoic and everything. And, man, he had some great stories, great attitude. That Danny Ainge story was absolutely amazing to think that he pranked Johnny Most like that on a commercial flight. On a commercial flight.
Yeah, that was
Johnny
Most
is lighting up explosive cigarettes.
I was just picturing like Joe Schmo in the next row looking over and Johnny Most is lighting up exploding cigarettes.
I mean, that is
amazing.
Absolutely
amazing.
Amazing to think. And then it just struck me that he's out there in Golden State and playing for some bad teams. And he set a record. No one has played as much basketball in the NBA as Robert Parrish. We could have lost out on a 20-year career if Red Auerbach hadn't pulled that heist.
Yeah, you think about that. And it just makes you so much about the NBA is circumstance and surroundings. And I mean, you see it every year with a lot of different guys. You think about even on the current team, Evan Turner said he had stopped appreciating basketball for a couple of years just because in Philadelphia and Indiana, things weren't working out for him. And then he gets to Boston and he's loving it. And the Chief, I mean, he played 21 years and he was ready to retire early because the Warriors were so damn bad. And so it goes to show a lot about A, how good those Celtics teams were, and B, how fun they were to play for, and how much those guys appreciated the times that they spent with together and playing basketball. And they didn't even, seems like they didn't even really love each other as people. They weren't, a lot of them weren't close friends, but it didn't matter because on the court they made magic.
Yeah,
and they appreciated the magic so much that Parrish damn near wanted to play forever.
Yeah, and you know, I think that is a great story that he told. I like the way he put it because it sounds harsh when he says, well, we were not friends. And I think because of the tone, just the natural cadence of Robert Parrish's voice, initially it sounded harsh, but you don't have to be friends with everybody on the team. You don't have to go out 12, 13, 14 guys and be, you know, happy, happy all the time. I have a hard time thinking that Tyler Zeller calls up Jay Crowder and says, hey, man, want to go to the club tonight? Like, I don't think that's happening. You have certain friends on the team, guys you're friendly with. You know, look, him, DJ, Bill Walton, that how much fun would it have been to hang out with him, DJ, and Bill Walton?
I mean, whenever you throw Bill Walton into the mix,
I know Bill Walton.
You never know where the night's gonna go, man.
I mean, those guys probably had a lot of fun, but I can also, of course, Larry Bird was a private guy. He didn't do much. I mean, besides pound a case of Bud, but I mean, he wouldn't have gone out with. I can see that. I can see them not hanging out, but once you're in the locker room, that professionalism, and like you said, friendly, no animosity. They liked each other. They just weren't friends, quote unquote. And the initial Jordan story, by the way, where he's like, you want some? Come get some.
Too funny. And he was, he had done 10 years of Kung Fu, man. You did not want to mess with Robert Parrish.
No, not at all.
That's why I asked him how close he was to fighting Jordan, because I feel like that fight would not have gone well for Jordan. We're like Jordan in a fight. Oh man, that would have been special.
Kind of makes that like the pounding that he gave Lambeer, which is why I brought that up. He rattled off a few good ones. You kind of see a little bit of that kung fu influence on the pounding on Lambeer.
As he said, he could handle himself.
I'd love to hear Robert Parrish just talk about going against Bill Lambeer all the time. Like we gotta try and get him back at some point and just go into those rivalries. That we didn't even get a chance to talk that much about the Lakers and all of that stuff. We could have had him on for 2 hours, but we couldn't keep him on for that long.
I loved when you asked him about them not liking teams or hating teams. And he said it was a strong dislike, and then he rattled off like three quarters of the team in the league.
I wanted to follow up and say, well, did you like anybody? But then the conversation went a different way. I'm sure they didn't like anybody. It sounded like all of the good teams they didn't like because they saw them as competition, and the bad teams they probably didn't care about. That's probably the way it boiled down.
Yeah.
So, well, look, that was another amazing conversation. I can't believe I'm letting my fandom kind of come out a little bit here. I cannot believe that I just called Robert Parrish and had a long, pleasant conversation about basketball. Like that, to me, having grown up, falling in love with the Celtics in the 80s, that is an amazing thing to me. Like, I can't. So I just wanted everyone to know that how giddy I am. In fact, so giddy that Jay and I took about 10 minutes after the end of the conversation with Robert to just geek out completely. You're not going to hear it. I'm going to edit all that out. But we just had like 10-minute, like, complete fanboy breakdown, which was awesome.
Yes. Having Robert Parrish on the Reigning Jays is fun 100% of the time. I'll never forget that Johnny Mo story. That's incredible.
It's so fantastic. All right. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna put this podcast out. You guys can listen to it. It stands forever. You can listen to it whenever. We're gonna talk about the actual Celtics. We'll do a little more. We'll let them play the Suns, and we'll talk about a few of the things that is going on with the team as they head into the road trip. We'll put that show out tomorrow, so you'll get like two shows this weekend. Maybe tomorrow night we'll put that show out. So for now, enjoy the Robert Parrish Show. We hope you enjoy the Robert Parrish Show. And thank you all for listening. And go see Robert Parrish at the Square One Mall in April. And we'll see you, I guess, next time on the Rain and Jays podcast tomorrow or whenever, whatever.
Is that the new iPhone?
Yeah, got it on T-Mobile. Fastest iPhone deserves America's fastest LTE network.
Introducing the amazing iPhone 8. It's the best iPhone yet, now on America's best unlimited network. For a limited time, save up to $300 on the amazing iPhone 8 after 24 monthly bill credits. And now join T-Mobile's iPhone upgrade program for free.
Eligible trade-in and finance agreement required. If you cancel service, you may lose promo credits. Contact us for details. Video at 480p. Small fraction of users over 50 gigs per month may have reduced speed. See store for details.